This is Let's Talk Synesthesia, the podcast where I, Micah, psychologist and synesthesia artist, meet scientists and synesthetes from around the world to explore the fascinating world of synesthesia. So come along and let's meet today's guest. Hello, everybody, and happy Tuesday. I'm back with a new episode this week after skipping a week. I'm sure you all did use the time wisely and went back to old episodes. And now we can start fresh with a new episode. It's a good one. It's one that was in the making for a bit. And it's one I'm really excited about because we will hear a lot of different voices. By the way, I'm on a walk in Innsbruck right now in Austria. Innsbruck is such a gorgeous place. If you ever get the chance to visit, do. I moved here when I was 20, went to university here, and it's just gorgeous. Okay, so back to what I was trying to tell you. We're gonna meet Pete in a bit and speak about his theater play. He is an actor and director, and he wrote a play as part of his PhD. And the play is fantastic. It covers voice hearing, synesthesia, autism. It touches on the question of what is real and what isn't, who gets to decide what is normal, what needs to be treated and in what way. A lot of big questions that we as a society should talk about. I really liked the conversation, and Pete is a fantastic person. I really enjoyed watching the play as well. Now, what I would want to do is give everybody access to the play or a ticket, and we would all just go watch it and then return to the episode. But I can't do that. But what I can do, and that's what I did, I asked Pete if he could write a summary about the plot of the play. And then I asked my wonderful friend Jess if she could read it out to us. So we're going to start today's episode with a bit of an audiobook. And then at the very end of the episode, we're going to hear voice notes from different people that were involved in the play, such as James Warneton and a couple other people. Good. So, okay, so now we're going to jump into the story. But what you can do in the next 2 to 5 seconds is give the podcast a rating. That would help me a ton. I wanted to get more exposure, but it's quite hard to reach a bigger audience. So I really need your help. Oh, and then I have another announcement to make. Stephen Melton, who was on the podcast a couple weeks ago, he is the guy that decided to come up with a Synesthesia Awareness Day. Now, I think the time was running away a bit, and of course he has lots of projects going on, so he decided to not host a panel this year, but next year, which gives him a lot more time to prepare. Kind of sad, but very understandable. But I'm thinking about a smaller alternative. I'll keep you updated on that. Okay, so review the podcast and dive into the audiobook, and then we will meet Pete in a couple minutes.
The title of the play is The Possibility of Color. In a dystopian very near future, a new miracle cure has been created. Designed by the AI-controlled Vigil Corporation, the implant promises to cure all mental illness by normalizing any human brain. For many, the implant is an irresistible guarantee of eternal happiness, a life without suffering. For others, though, it's a terrifying instrument of control, stripping them of what it means to be human and increasingly forced upon a growing number of compulsory recipients. Joseph is a painfully shy and nervous, yet extremely talented architect who rarely leaves the safety of his home studio. He enjoys his modest success and is largely content with his life. He is secretly infatuated with his business partner and only friend, Helen, but sees her as way out of his league. At the beginning of the play, we hear from Helen that their current clients are not quite happy with the design Joseph has created for their new beachfront villa. An architectural model of this house is on stage throughout the play. While the clients accept that it has to be completely white because of the strict planning rules for the plot, they insist that it's too white and needs to have the possibility of color. Both Joseph and Helen think that this is a ridiculous and impossible request, but Helen still leaves it up to Joseph to come up with a solution, informing him that she's set up a meeting between him and the clients in 2 weeks where he can explain his ideas. This sends Joseph into a panic, as he never meets clients, insisting that this is Helen's job. Helen ignores his objections, telling him it's a great opportunity to challenge his fears and be more outgoing. Whilst he initially doesn't see himself as a potential recipient of the implant, Helen suggests that it might be a good option for him, as it would make him less anxious and more confident. She describes how a guy she knew at school called Ed, who was previously just as shy and awkward as Joseph, has had the implant and is now unrecognizably confident and charming, to the point that Helen is excited to have been asked out by Ed. What Helen doesn't know at this point is that Joseph is a synesthete, with his main type being words-to-taste synesthesia. Joseph keeps this a secret as he is terrified that people will think he is weird if he reveals it. Helen initially appears to be the polar opposite of Joseph. She is confident, outspoken, stylish, and relentlessly optimistic. However, after the date with Ed ends in disaster, we learn that her positivity and confidence are very much a mask. In reality, Helen is a desperate, lonely, barely functioning alcoholic filled with self-loathing. She reveals to Joseph that she is considering having the implant because she wants to be loved. The third main character in the play is Ashlyn, Joseph's long-lost sister. She is a voice hearer and regards her two main voices, Lucas and Molly, as her best friends. Her largely positive relationship with her voices is complex, with the constantly angry and verbally abusive Lucas being reminiscent of her father, whilst the cheery but vulnerable Molly is essentially an eight-year-old version of Ashlyn. The final main character is Vigil, the Alexa-like voice of the AI-controlled Vigil Corporation. Vigil seems to run everything, from the intuitive home AI assistant to the entire country's banking system and now fully privatized health service. After Ashlyn's local support group is shut down, she starts to struggle and eventually loses her dead-end job. As she is now even more reliant on welfare payments, she is forced to ask her local doctor to sign her off sick for a couple of weeks before she begins applying for new jobs. This is to give her time to find a new support group. She is surprised that her usual doctor no longer works at her local health center and that all initial consultations are now performed by Vigil through a new fully automated AI algorithm. After a series of judgments by Vigil, resulting in potential sanctions being imposed on Ashlyn's welfare payments, and increasing distress and anger from Ashlyn at the infuriating computer says no inflexibility, Vigil eventually recommends that Ashlyn should have the implant fitted. When Ashlyn refuses this as a treatment option, Vigil locks the doors and informs Ashlyn that she has been approved as a compulsory recipient of the implant and is being detained until the procedure has been carried out. Ashlyn, now terrified and out of control, picks up her chair and threatens to start breaking things unless they open the doors. Vigil calls on security to forcibly sedate her. The central scene in the play sees Joseph visiting Ashlyn in hospital. The premise of this visit is that it is up to Joseph, as Ashlyn's next of kin, to decide if Ashlyn should have the implant or not. If he decides that she shouldn't have it, he will need to care for Ashlyn for the rest of her life or his. During her visit, Ashlyn remembers that Joseph once described a character from Thomas the Tank Engine as tasting like custard creams, and then encourages Joseph to reveal the details of his synesthesia to her. After swearing her to secrecy, Joseph describes his experiences, at first reluctantly, but then, encouraged by Ashlyn's delighted response, he enthusiastically reveals more and more detail, including how he uses his synesthesia to create his beautiful architectural designs, and also how his favorite words taste of rich chocolate cake, although he refuses to reveal what the word is. He specifically describes one of the design elements of the building he is working on, the one that requires the possibility of color. It has a large light well that captures sunlight and channels it throughout the inside of the house. As he describes it, we hear beautiful music and we see delicate white light projections extending into the sky from the top of the house. This is another key element of Joseph's synesthesia, which he describes as what happens when something is really important. Ashlyn is enthralled by this and enthusiastically compares it to her own experiences of voice hearing, as well as her ability to fly, and another gift she claims to have, where she magically helps people to work out big problems in their life by just being around them or by leaving something in their pocket. She describes these abilities as superpowers and declares that the two of them are superhero siblings. Joseph rejects this idea, insisting that his taste thing, as he describes it, is real, whereas her experience, for example, her voices, aren't. This upsets Ashlyn, and she makes Joseph promise to never say that about her best friends ever again. Ashlyn explains how terrified she is at the thought of losing her voices, and hence why she can't have the implant. She begs Joseph to help her, and she promises to be helpful if she has to come and live with him. After explaining all the reasons she doesn't want the implant, she is horrified to discover that Joseph is considering having it himself, in the hope that it would make him more lovable. She encourages him to tell Helen about his synesthesia and explains that if he has the implant, he won't just lose his anxiety and awkwardness, he'll lose his synesthesia. Joseph becomes overwhelmed by this realization and tries to leave, but Ashlyn convinces him to stay so she can tell him one last thing. She reveals that she has a large piece of glass hidden in her trousers and that she will kill herself if he doesn't let her come home with him. Now panicking, Joseph hits the emergency call button, bringing the voice of Vigil back to the room. He tells Vigil not to give Ashlyn the implant and that Ashlyn can come home with him. Vigil is concerned about his decision and asks if Joseph will stay a few more minutes while Vigil asks Ashlyn some questions. He reluctantly agrees and then watches as Vigil interrogates Ashlyn about her third voice. Ashlyn insists she only has two voices, but then we hear the voice of a woman, which sends Ashlyn into a terrifying and disturbing meltdown. It's now clear that the third voice is the voice of their mother, who repeatedly apologizes for what happened to Ashlyn at the hands of her abusive father. We also learn that their mother died just before Ashlyn and Joseph were separated. With Ashlyn collapsed on the floor in tears, Vigil asks Joseph if he now understands why Ashlyn needs the implant. He says yes and asks to leave, but Ashlyn jumps up, grabbing him from behind and holding the piece of glass to his neck. She threatens to kill him unless Vigil lets them leave. Vigil assures Joseph that Ashlyn won't hurt him and tells Ashlyn that she knows this because she's in her head. Ashlyn realizes that she hasn't heard her voices for a while, and then it slowly dawns on her that she's already had the implant fitted and Vigil is talking to her directly from the implant. She releases Joseph, holds the glass to her own neck and tries to cut it, but her arm freezes involuntarily and robotically lowers to her side. Vigil, now in complete control of Ashlyn, asks Joseph to take the glass from Ashlyn, which he does, and places it in his coat pocket. Vigil now fully activates the implant, and Ashlyn suddenly appears completely calm, with no recollection of Joseph even arriving. Vigil explains to Joseph that he has 24 hours to decide whether Ashlyn should keep the implant or not, otherwise it will be made permanent. In the final scene, Joseph, exhausted and emotional after the visit, wakes in his studio as an excited and energetic Helen enters. He tries to tell Helen what happened during the visit, and that he's not sure what to do about Ashlyn's implant, but Helen stops him and quickly convinces him that removing the implant from Ashlyn would be an act of cruelty. He tentatively agrees before Helen reveals why she's so excited. While Joseph was visiting Ashlyn, Helen was having a consultation for the implant. She decides she's definitely going to have it, and there's an even more exciting development. She's discovered that if a couple have the implant together, they can be paired for life, guaranteeing everlasting love and companionship. She sheepishly asks Joseph if he'd like to join her, and he quickly accepts. They're both excited, even agreeing to get married and have children, but the mood quickly dips as Joseph's mind returns to Ashlyn. This infuriates Helen, who is determined for this to be a happy day, and she declares that she's going to buy champagne to celebrate and some chocolate cake. The mention of chocolate cake stops Joseph in his tracks, remembering his conversation with Ashlyn about his synesthesia. He tells Helen he has to tell her something important and goes on to reveal all his secrets, including how he designs all his buildings using the taste he experiences by looking at or even just thinking about her. Finally, he reveals that her name, Helen, tastes of the richest, sweetest, most delicious chocolate cake you could ever imagine. He concludes by telling her that he can't have the implant and he doesn't want her to have it either. After a few moments of calm, Helen erupts furiously, accusing Joseph of selfishly prioritizing his own needs over hers. He insists that he can make her happy, but she ridicules this idea, mocking his ability to look after himself, let alone help her. She reveals how miserable and tired she is and how desperate she is for someone to push a button and make her forget. Joseph has no answer to this, and Helen goes to leave. He begs her to stay, and she pauses before ridiculing him once more, describing how awkward, scared, and lost he is, and how that's never going to do it for her. As a last attempt at making him understand, she tells him that she's having the implant so that she can love herself, but she wants him to have it so she can love him. She gives him one last chance to change his mind, begging him. He says he's sorry, and she leaves. Joseph breaks down and begins to wreck his studio in a rage, before he puts his hand in his pocket and finds the piece of glass that he took from Ashlyn. He calmly tidies the mess that he's made, and once satisfied, he holds the glass to his neck. But he can't go through with it. He sits at his desk and holds the glass to his wrist, bracing for the pain. Light from the desk lamp refracts through the glass and shines a rainbow onto his face. He pauses, then approaches the model of the house he's designing, the one that is too white. He places the glass in the light well and turns the lamp on above it. Beautiful music plays as colored light floods through the model house. Joseph laughs as his previously white synesthetic visions above the house explode in kaleidoscope color. Blackout.
Hi, Pete.
Hi, Micah. Very nice to be here.
Thank you so much for being here. Can you tell me how your last name is pronounced?
Yes, it's Carruthers. Carruthers. Yes. It's one of them where when someone asks me to pronounce it, I then start going, oh my God, how do I pronounce it? Carruthers? Pete Carruthers. Yeah.
Cool. I'm not going to repeat it. I don't want to insult your last name.
Don't bother. And I'll just stick to Micah because, yeah, I'm not sure about that strange symbol in your name either. Yeah.
That's a German letter and it is just a double S.
Okay. Yes.
I'm glad we covered that. So I have a couple of questions for you at the very beginning and then we're going to talk about your play and all the topics related and how it came about.
Mm-hmm.
So my first question would be, who are you?
Who am I? Wow, how long have we got? So I'm Pete, obviously, as you know. I'm an actor, writer, director, researcher. Yes, that's me professionally, I suppose. I'm also a father of three. I was in the military for 7 years, so that's another little bit about me before I went into the arts. So that's always something that drives a bit of conversation, but a bit of interest. It's a strange path into the arts. Yeah, I could waffle because I'm so self-obsessed. So I could waffle for hours. So please stop me.
Okay, I'll just give you a new question then.
Okay.
Where are you from and where are you recording from?
So I was born and raised in a town called Horwich near Bolton in the north of England, not far from Manchester. But I now live a little bit further away than that. I'm just over the border in Yorkshire in a little village called Coaling in the countryside. And I'm currently talking to you in a loft.
Mm. My last question or my third question would be, what forms of synesthesia do you have? But I know that you don't have synesthesia yourself. So I think my question would be, how did the play come about? How did you make it about synesthesia? What's your relationship with synesthesia? And I think that's just a good segue.
Absolutely. I think, yeah, I've been thinking about this because I'm preparing a presentation next week, actually, that's going to touch on this in terms of where it came from and how it relates to me and my story. I remember as a child, really struggling to kind of understand the world and understand people, and struggled, I think, empathy. No, I understand it. I struggle to really just in my gut understand people and connect with them, and find myself fascinated by people, but very difficult to understand them. So fast forward many years, went into science, a science-based career as an engineer in the Air Force, and then got very bored. Then got this career in an arts, you know, retrained as an actor. As I was doing my training as an actor, my eldest son had just been diagnosed with autism. And I was really struggling with some of the messages that he was getting from family, professionals, teachers, that were kind of like, you need to hide this about yourself, or you need to do this to fit in more. You need to look at what the other kids are doing and do what they're doing, talk about what they're talking about. And I find that really difficult, because I think perhaps subconsciously I was probably seeing a lot of myself in him as a child as well. But also I just wanted him to celebrate who he was. I thought he was fascinating, and he saw the world in a novel, exciting, unusual, unpredictable way that I just, you know, wouldn't think to ask. That was kind of the seed of the play, in terms of who gets to, what is normal, and who gets to decide what those rules are, where those boundaries are. And then I started to do, write different versions of the play over the years. And I then started to learn about voice hearing, and how, I'd always thought of voice hearing as schizophrenia, as this scary illness that people have for life, Whereas I then found that there's the hearing voices movement, and watched a video on YouTube by Eleanor Longden, which, if you've not seen it, please check it out. It's fascinating, about how some people see voices as a positive thing and have a positive relationship with their voices, almost like they're friends. And it made me start to think, okay, so maybe there are, there are ways of experiencing the world that some of us see as negative. Who makes those decisions? And then I kind of wanted a contrast. So there was this one character who heard voices and one character who was very much on the autistic spectrum, although there are no diagnoses stated in the play. And then I came across the work of James Wannerton, particularly his London Tube map, which I'm sure all your listeners are aware of now. And that I just found that so exciting. And it just made me think about that question of, okay, so there are some things that we experience that most people don't, that we see as a positive thing. For instance, I saw that map and I thought, I'd love to try that. I'd love to be able to taste a word and see what that's like. And then I found the work of Caitlin Hover, I know you spoke to recently, who, sees coloured light when she hears music. And I thought, that sounds amazing. And who wouldn't want to try that? That sounds like a real trip, in a positive way. Whereas if you compare and contrast that to someone who hears voices or has visions or, that kind of unusual experience, that we see that as terrifying and scary and something that is an illness and needs to be treated. And where does that come from? Particularly when I found that there was correlation between, that people with autism are more likely to have synesthesia. Thankfully, I was very lucky to speak to James several times over the last few years as I've been researching the play. And, talking more about that, and it made sense that the character who was on the spectrum would also have synesthesia as well. And yeah, that relationship kind of came from there, that compare and contrast, I suppose, and using it to learn from each other, I suppose. Yeah.
Yeah, the stigma is so real around voice hearing, isn't it? I can still remember the day I learned at medical school. Some people don't want their voices to go away. And we were all like, oh, what? Well, that's new. Okay, that's a new perspective. So they can also be positive. Now I know that, but I can still remember that feeling of, oh, that was a misconception I had. And I'm sure that movies and media does its part for us to carry around that stigma still for hallucinations and voice hearing. And it's also a lot more common than we think, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I think, like you say, the media, the way it's portrayed in films, and when we hear the only time we hear on the news about someone who is perhaps experiencing hallucination is when there's been someone who's committed some violent crime, and then they draw attention to the fact that they were they'd been treated for psychosis and this kind of thing, and it just perpetuates that myth that people, and it is a proven myth, that people who have hallucinations are more likely to commit crime, because that's actually the fact that they are less likely. They are more likely to be the victims of crime and to be the victims of violence. So as much as we keep saying that, it's still there in our gut. It's kind of driven into us culturally. Whereas in other cultures around the world, you know, voice, hearing and visions is seen as a real positive thing. You know, these people are seen as soothsayers, you know, as oracles. And, you know, we have to look at how culture and fear has driven our understanding of it. You know, I remember when I first shared on a synesthesia group that this play kind of compares the two, you know, hallucinations and synesthesia. There was a few people that were sort of saying, well, I don't know if that's a good thing that we should be comparing the two because they're absolutely different. You know, synesthesia is very different to hallucinations. We shouldn't risk them being confused as the same thing. And
yeah, but that is just reenacting stigma, isn't it?
Exactly. And it's understandable because why would you want to associate with a group of people who are stigmatized if you're currently not, you know, and I can understand that as it's an understandable reaction to that. But yeah, it's just stopping and asking, you know, is it not more that we should be questioning why there is stigma associated to one of those and trying to help each other understand each other?
But I just want to add to what you've said before about how hallucinations are perceived culturally. We just can't forget that for many people, hallucinations are horrible and terrifying and do have a very negative effect on their well-being.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think the last thing I want to do is be evangelistic about, oh, no, you know, hallucinations are always a positive thing. Of course they're not. You know, of course, a lot of people find them really difficult and people have very complex relationships. One of the people who contributed really quite heavily to the research of the play Who Hears Voices, she talked about how, yeah, there were times when she would have taken the implant, you know, she would have wanted to turn those voices off and those extra sounds that she was bombarded with day after day after day. But she also values them on some days, but she does find them exhausting, you know, and I know.
Yeah. So let's focus on the implant for a second. Mm-hmm. How did the idea came about of the implant? I think it gives you so much to think about. And I'm not sure if the summary was exhaustive on what the implant is. Maybe you can explain it in your own words.
Oh, that's a tricky one because it definitely evolved. It wasn't a light bulb moment. I think it was through trying to find a metaphor between a metaphor for medication, I suppose, and about how sometimes we might offer medication through good faith, you know, and saying we found that this is useful for someone with depression or someone who, you know, who has hallucinations or whatever that drug and that, you know, experience is that we're trying to help. Or it might be that drug is offered without fully disclosing what the side effects might be or how addictive it might be, how permanent it could therefore be that you are taking that drug or relying on that drug, and how sometimes people are deemed to not be able to make a choice for themselves, and how we say, right, you have to have that. We are making this decision. You are forced to have it, and even forcibly, you know, injecting or, you know, administering it in some other way. And it was like, how do I simplify that? But also I think looking at progress, and I was thinking, you know, obviously artificial intelligence plays a big part in the play as well, about what do we do when we have artificial intelligence? You know, we could be close to the point where there's certainly aspects cognition that AI will do better than us. And what about if we get to the point where it takes an AI algorithm to understand the complex processes that go on within our brain to the point that we cannot understand and we will never be able to understand that is beyond us? Do we trust an AI program to then help us because they have that insight that we won't have? If they create something and that provides something that seems to be beneficial, you know, yeah, what problems have we presented the AI to solve? What have we asked them to mm-hmm. fix? You know, and that comes back to, I think, the whole question in psychiatry as a whole, you know, that thing of what is treatment? What is an improved outcome for someone? Is it that they have a better quality of life? Is it that they're happy within themselves? Or is it that they are more reliable, that they're able to work more, they're easier to manage, they're less likely to cause problems? You know, these are the questions that I was asking, I suppose. And what the implant did, I think, was, I think, quite simply, but not too explicitly, kind of bring that together as a concept.
Mm-hmm. Well, it did exactly that. I think the implant in your play is very, very powerful. And it kept me thinking about many, many things.
at the very end of the play, we also hear them talk about how you can have a partnership implant where your happiness, your libido, everything you want in life is synchronized with your partner, and you will want the same stuff until you die, which is such a fascinating idea to think about. Would we want that? Because it does sound amazing, doesn't it?
It does in a way, but I think, again, that is, it's asking questions about what we see as a successful relationship, you know, and what society would prefer, you know. We and I think, you know, it doesn't take much of a leap to understand where my kind of thinking is. I'm, you know, when someone is married for 60 years, for instance, we say, congratulations, that is amazing. That is an amazing achievement. And I think, well, I don't know, you know, why, yeah. Why are they still together? Are they happy? Have they just learned to cope with each other because the shame of splitting up? You know, I know people who've stayed together because of that, because it would be too embarrassing.
And the financial, especially for women.
Exactly. And, you know, people are more able to work and help each other work, and they don't take up as much housing, you know, and all these kind of social things that start to creep in when you start to think about it, of why it's beneficial. And that was a big thing about the implant and about who it's imposed on. And it started to become clear to me that it wouldn't be about helping people. It would be about what is beneficial to society in the terms of those that have the power, you know, what makes people more cost effective, makes people less likely to rise up and cause problems, you know, those kind of quite dark things that kind of start to creep in at that point.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, we'd absolutely want people to stay together forever and for there to be no marriage breakups and for them to just have that. It's that dream, isn't it? It's that fairy tale that we're told as a child, you know, you meet the one and you stay together forever and it's happily ever after. Wow, this is making that fairy tale real. How wonderful is that?
Yeah, all of that sounds tempting, and I think that that's what your play wanted to do. No, not all of that, the last bit sounds tempting, but I think as someone who has all these sensory issues, of course it's so nice to think, whoa, I would just live a life in bliss and happiness. But I think, like you said, we spoke about that at Nottingham University 2 days ago, where
mm-hmm.
you presented your play to a group of students. The equivalent to an implant is to take antidepressant that cure that part of struggles, but I can still be myself.
It's about opening up balanced discussions about patient choice, you know, and not just patient choice, but, you know, you getting us to ask questions as a society about who we are and what makes us human being and what are the positive aspects of humanity that we want to maintain, because we're getting to the point where we can start to control who we are and what we experience. Yeah. And we have to ask those big questions, I think. But it's about that complex, messy, you know, discussion that will vary from everyone's personal experience in terms of what is right for them. Infinite times with whoever's in front of you, you know, to ask them what their experience is, what their story is, what sense they've made of things that have happened to them in their life and how they're feeling right now and what they want to do about it, what's available to them.
Mm-hmm. The other topic besides like medication and psychiatry, the implant, is the very big topic of how can we create a world where our perceptual differences and differences in general have enough space to not be a disadvantage. How can we create a world where people listen to each other, really embrace the differences and not get scared, don't want everything to be in like the boxes they already know? Because in the fast-paced world we have right now, there isn't that much space to do that. And then we want to cover it. And then I think then that's again where suppression and defense mechanisms and all of that stuff comes in, where we then maybe end up taking medication again.
Yeah. Wow. So many things. And for one thing, I think that is the point of the play, to open up those conversations, to start that process. And, you know, I don't see it as a lesson in itself, the play. I see it as a conversation starter about presenting different sides of an argument and getting us to kind of come face to face with what we're dealing with. And then hopefully, because we've empathized with those characters and felt, you know, different sides of the story, as if we were kind of in it ourselves, it kind of just calms everyone down, I think, and gets everyone to kind of have a shared experience that is a good start for a more constructive, brave, kind, compassionate conversation around it. And that's why not only have we got student nurses and other health professionals coming to see it, we've got people with lived experience of, you know, the themes that are explored in the play coming as well to take part in those conversations, but also the wider public who we want to see the play as well to kind of open that up. And, you know, the thing is, it will just be a small part. You know, we're not going to reach everywhere in the world with this play, and it won't have the same effect on any two single people. It needs time, you know, it needs patience. But I think, yeah, it's in conflict to the way the world is set up. It's ever more fast-paced. There's ever more pressure put on us to consume, to produce, to feed into that machine. One thing I'm absolutely certain of is that we keep talking about the mental health pandemic. We have to understand that mental health, you know, what is it? It's people responding. I don't believe that the majority of mental health is to do with an illness or a disease or some, you know, some wiring problem or whatever else. I think it's people making rational, understandable responses to stimuli, to pressures, to power, to control, to trauma, to, you know, all these things that are building up on us in this ever more scary world with climate change, with, you know, war and, you know, inflation problems at the moment, you know, the economy, and, you know, there's so much fear and anger and pressure and lack of time and lack of energy and lack of money that it's becoming harder and harder to stop and have these conversations about, is this the future we wanted to design for ourselves? Because we've made this. We've designed our society. And do we have to just kind of keep going on that path, or is there a better way? Yeah.
So what practical change would you like to see in the next couple of years?
Obviously at the moment I'm focused on getting as many health professionals as possible to see the play, to help them to be compassionate, to help them to have empathy and to see the value in listening to stories. At the end of the day, stories is what I'm passionate about. And I think that if we can stop and be interested in each other's stories and not just put people in a box, you know, to think about all humans as being on an infinite number of spectrums, you know, rather than this kind of more binary digital approach we've got of you're either in that box or you're not. We're more likely on that kind of spectrum in anything you want to think about. And I think that probably accounts for synesthesia, for hallucinations, for mood, you know, depression and emotional responses and that kind of thing. But I also want to have the play reach people further up, you know, with real power, people in, you know, those policymakers.
I think it's wonderful to see that mental health is not as big, like the stigma is less big than it was a couple decades ago. So a lot is happening. And I think the internet is also doing its amazing things when it comes to sharing stories, hearing stories. I think it connects people in a very wonderful way. Don't have to talk about social media disadvantages now, but I think it also does a wonderful thing of connecting people. And that's what I see in the synesthesia community. And yeah, in terms of mental health in general.
The other thing, I agree that it's much better that people are talking about it. But I still wonder if, you know, I think that there are studies that show that the stigma is still there, even though we're more able to talk about it, that still by labeling ourselves or labeling each other, that we're still othering people and going, oh, that's great that I understand that you have depression or that you have anxiety now. But there is still a stigma then still attached to it. People might be more patient and more sympathetic, but it still makes that an other. And I think I still have questions around the problems that sometimes come along with diagnostic labeling and how that can still separate us in some ways.
Where I see the line for stigma for sure is there is something really interesting happening in the German language. I'm trying to explain it to you because it's exactly that kind of moving the stigma around. So in English, it's mental health. And in German, it's psychische Gesundheit. Now, what people did, especially on social media, they now call psychische Gesundheit mentale Gesundheit. So they took that mental from the English language and talk about their mental health in real social media and whatever. But what they wouldn't do is, and that's where the othering is in place, and I dislike it so much, is they would never talk about a person with schizophrenia and talk about their mentale Gesundheit. You know what I mean? They would always use psychische, the word we used all those years, the stigmatized word, they still belong in that category of psychische Gesundheit. But now the stuff we talk about is now mentale Gesundheit because it's more hipster. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. It's like, well, you're welcome because we can see that you're safe. You might be a bit sad or whatever, but that's fine. But you're still scary, so you need to stay in that box because we're not quite sure about you yet. And I think, you know, it's that pick and choose. Yeah, who holds the door? Who holds the kind of the rule book? And I think, again, it comes down to fear and not understanding each other. And I think this is what I meant to come back to this before. This is why I've compared synesthesia and hallucinations in the play, because like you say, we see quite often when we hear about synesthesia, we see it as this, oh, wow, that's fascinating. That sounds great. You know, I wouldn't be scared if someone told me that they, you know, that they had that experience. Whereas if I hear these voices, then I would. It's more about, I think, could we, with synesthesia, the fact that it is predictable, the fact that it is, you know, consistent, makes it easier to study. And maybe we'll learn, use that to learn more about what's happening in the brain and what's happening with the different, you know, processes that are going on that might create a hallucination, you know, because at the end of the day, when it comes down to it, it's seeing something, you know, and it's us interpreting the world in a different way. You know, there's no such thing as color. It's, you know, it's different wavelengths of magnetic radiation that we process in a certain way. And some brains might process it slightly different and might process it from a different stimuli. But how would I feel? And that's what the play does. You know, how would I feel if I was in that situation?
Yeah, that's a whole thing. Like, to ask questions, you need the self-awareness. Like, you need the introspection. You need the language. And if you don't have that, you can't ask those questions because you can't even distinguish within yourself. It needs a whole set of skills to ask someone interesting questions about it.
And it's really, really difficult, particularly when there's fear and emotions and all the sorts of things influencing our judgments. You know, it's a really, really tricky thing to do.
Yeah. And to just cover the topic of what's the difference and what's the similarities of hallucinations, because I feel like we've used both words a million times now, but we still haven't really said what we know about it. Well, on the last episode, Sean, the president of the International Synesthesia Association, he explained to us that a hallucination doesn't have a stimulus, whereas synesthesia has a stimulus and it's always the same and it's consistent. And then there's also a paper, the paper you sent me. We're not going to be able to cover it today, but I'll just give us the title. It's Reflections on Synesthesia Perception and Cognition by Sajiv Ibeji and Ben Tal. And I'm gonna post the citation on Instagram when I post about our episode, so people can go and read the paper. It also dives into like perceptual differences. Why is there a similarity between synesthesia and hallucinations? And why is it not the same thing?
Fantastic.
Another question I had for you was, it is now part of the mental health nurses training, because that's a huge success, isn't it? Congrats. Like, that is what, that's exactly where you would have imagined it to be, isn't it?
Thank you. Yeah, it's still very much, I think, a trial thing, but, you know, I'm doing a PhD at the moment on the use of film and theatre in the training of health professionals, in particular in the training of compassionate and reflective health professionals, to be specific. And that's looking at how effective this approach is, how and why people respond differently to this kind of training compared to more traditional approaches, and also trying to work out how to do it more effectively, you know, to do it as best as we can, through sharing that with Health Education England, who've now actually become part of NHS England. As one qualified mental health nurse described it, said it's real life experience in a safe environment. You can predict that if someone comes and watches this play, they will spend 2 hours experiencing someone who goes through quite difficult experience that we can learn from, without anyone suffering, without anyone being at risk, without anyone, you know, so that the nurses or whoever it is that's coming to see it can just absorb themselves in the story and live that life themselves for 2 hours, without having that responsibility to help the patient in real time, you know.
Interesting. Yeah, that's a good way to put it. It's like a mini internship.
Yeah.
Responsibility.
Yeah.
I'm very, very intrigued by it. I didn't value movies and presentations in my studies as much. It now makes me see all of that in a different light. So now you're touring around England with the play, aren't you?
Well, that's the next step. So we need to raise quite a lot of funding to be able to do it. But the idea is to do a national tour of the play, hopefully late next year. Probably if they want to get on the mailing list to find out about other opportunities, hopefully there'll be ways to watch it online at some point, maybe some sort of streaming arrangement. But if they go to treefishproductions.com, add themselves to the mailing list there, that's probably the easiest way to do it, I would say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We still have so much to talk about, but our listeners will still spend some time with the podcast listening to people involved in the play. You were amazing, and asked these people if they could share how they experienced being on the play, producing it. Some of them, I think, discovered their own synesthesia. So that's what we're gonna end with. It's a very three-dimensional episode today.
Yeah, I'm excited about that. I was listening to your podcast with Caitlin Hover the other week, and like she said, you know, that's perhaps the most exciting thing for her, when someone at any age can find, oh, that's me, you know.
There is something incredibly healing if you're suffering, but also reassuring that it's a shared experience, all of this colorful madness. It's fantastic.
Yeah. And would you like me to share a couple of those?
Are they not included in the voice notes we're going to hear now?
I think there are some in there, but I know there's more recently. I've got a couple of examples. If you wanted me to describe a couple quickly. Quickly sounds good. Okay, so one is my partner's stepmom, who at the age of 60 came and saw the play and realized that what she thought was something very different was actually synesthesia. She felt absolutely sure of it, that she has emotion to colour synesthesia, and she'd used that in her career as a therapist, and talked about how that often made her feel quite overwhelmed and exhausted after therapy because of that, you know, hypersensitivity that she felt. And that really helped her understand that. She described it as she sees like an aura around that person that corresponds to that colour, and it is the same colour for, the specific emotion that she's detecting. And the other one, which I've mentioned recently, and I think maybe this is slightly different, is I told you recently, I'd had a conversation with James Wallerton about, you know, he's been fantastic in terms of helping me research the play and teach me about synesthesia. But what he found was, when he first watched the play live, that something that he'd never said to anyone was that he hears voices, and that he has three very distinct voices, one that's very argumentative, one that's more questioning of that argumentative voice, and then his own voice that he hears that kind of ends the argument. And he talked to me at some length about how he'd struggled to come to terms with this, perhaps because of the stigma as well. But he said, although he's aware that it's very different from synesthesia, the fact that he has these voices, they have the same distracting effect on him. And that he uses the same techniques to avoid that distraction, to kind of cope with them. But what's really encouraging is, first of all, obviously he was absolutely happy for me to mention this today, and it's something that he wants to talk about more, you know, in the community. But he said that the play helped him make a bit more sense of those voices and what they were doing and what was going on for him.
It's really, really wholesome that you're. Play gave someone that level of community.
That's so exciting. Really exciting.
That was a weird expression, but still, you know what I mean. You must be really happy about tapping into his world even more than you thought you did.
Absolutely. It gives me goosebumps. It really does. That just shows that someone who has spent the vast majority of his life, like James, you know, campaigning and using himself as research for synesthesia, you know, and going through all those early kind of tests and things, can then still at this point be go, oh, there's something else about me that I wasn't quite I wasn't quite sure of, that I didn't quite understand, and I feel now encouraged to open up about it and talk about it and understand it a little bit more.
That's so beautiful. I'm mind blown. Thank you for sharing that piece of information. I'm definitely going to leave James a message. And if he, like you said, wants to talk about it a bit more, maybe he's open to share it here.
That would be great. Get him on again for a revisit. Yeah, I think that's what he said to me, that he wants to open this up. Maybe we can learn something a bit more there.
Yeah, and encourage people to talk about it, even though the stigma is very real. We need to talk about all these sexual differences. And a sentence that came to mind when we spoke about the differences a couple times is, we're not safe until everybody's safe.
Yeah, absolutely. Try and love everyone, for want of a less sort of fridge magnet phrasey type of thing. But yeah, let's just try and have a bit of love for everyone and a bit of empathy for each other and a bit of patience, yeah.
Yeah, those are wonderful words to end on, I think. Thank you so much for sharing the play with us. And I hope I'll get to see it in person.
I'm going to make sure of it, Micah. I'm going to make sure of it. Yeah. I'm sure we'll talk many times before we get to that point as well.
Cool. Okay, so then have a lovely day. Enjoy the English countryside. I am so jealous, even though it's very pretty here. I shouldn't complain.
Yeah, you're in Austria at the moment, right?
I'm in Germany today, going back to Austria tomorrow.
Okay, yeah. I've only been to Austria once, but it was very, very, very pretty. So, yeah.
It's kind of the best place on earth.
Well, there you go then. there's no room for envy then. I'm happy that you've got that.
Thank you. Okay. Have a lovely day.
I will do. You too.
Bye.
Bye.
My key takeaway from the performance was that everyone has their own story and not everything is visible on the surface. From watching the play, there were so many messages and concepts that come through, and I think this would be the same for everyone who watched the performance. The performance was gripping in that the storyline brings in a number of emotions and characters that are relatable, which helps draw you into that narrative. It's also a fun way of exploring different themes that are prevalent but maybe not as widely known about or discussed, like synesthesia, forced treatment, and the emerging use of artificial intelligence in healthcare.
Drawing the line between what's real and what isn't is really interesting because we can only ever see the world from our viewpoint. So really, everything is only real because we perceive it. I've had fascinating discussions with friends about things like colours. We all look in picture books when we're kids and you'll see paint splashes labelled purple and yellow and so on. But how do you actually know what someone else is seeing when they see purple, and how do you know it's the same as what you see? You don't, and you can't ever know for sure. Maybe the best way to work out what's real and what isn't is to explore other people's viewpoints, like the play invites you to do. We might not all know about what it's like to taste the greatest ever chocolate cake when you hear someone's name, but we do all know what it is to be happy when we see the people we love and then feel sad when they leave. And of course, it is possible for us to alter our feelings with medication in the same way that we see the implant working in the play. For me, one of the best things you can do in reality is share how you feel about something. You can't ever guarantee that your best friend will have the same feelings as you if they read your favourite book, but you can share your feelings about things with each other, and that's genuine.
I can understand the perceived connection between synesthetic experiences and hallucinations. After all, a synesthete can effectively see, hear, or indeed taste things that aren't actually there. There are a couple of fundamental differences, though. In the case of synesthesia, there's an inducer or trigger involved in the process. Hearing a sound can induce an involuntary taste. Looking at a colour can induce an involuntary sound. And synesthetic perceptions tend to be somewhat predictable and consistent over time. Hallucinations, or as far as I understand them anyway, don't appear to be the products of an obvious external or corresponding inducer, and these internally generated sensory perceptions are notoriously inconsistent.
The benefits this could have on the future healthcare is a different way of learning. So generally speaking, students would learn theoretical components in the university and then the application of that theory through practice and practical skills out in practice. The form of having a theatre performance is another engaging way to bring the two together that allows the viewer to make their own interpretations on the storyline, the impact on the person or the people, such as living with an illness, or what the impact of a diagnosis is on the person or the wider family, and then reflect on their own knowledge, values, and how that might influence them going into practice in the future. It's an innovative way to share experiences and the themes around health which will aid all of our learning and our approaches to care, and that goes for students, practitioners, family members, and also the general public.
My involvement with the possibility of colour began after Pete got in touch, asking me a series of questions relating to the lived-in experience of synesthesia. The reason for the questions being that he was developing a theatre production featuring a synesthete as a core character. I can remember Pete's tenacity and attention to detail during these early exchanges, and really from that moment on I was hooked. And when, a short time later, Pete asked if I'd join his scriptwriting team, I jumped at the chance. What makes this play such a valuable contribution is that synesthesia is just one of a number of neurodiverse traits portrayed accurately and with a touching sensitivity. It raises and explores many of the present issues within the mental health sector, such as the general perception and one-size-fits-all treatment of the neurodiverse. It asks the question, what is normal? And most importantly, I think it emphasises the need for change within the present system, including the relentless pressure to conform, which can lead to masking and all sorts of other coping strategies. And that's not a particularly good compromise in my view. I would love to see all students, especially those involved in health and well-being, being given the opportunity to take in the possibility of colour as part of their professional training.
The things I've particularly thought about after watching the play were the impact of compulsory treatment, a lack of treating people as individuals when formulating treatment plans, especially when technology with yes-no scenarios is used to make black and white decisions, and how the perception of normal behaviour and reactions is both changing, but behaviour considered atypical still carries a lot of stigma. Compulsory treatment is something we've seen a lot of in the media, and on the whole I think people's perception of it is negative, but it can also be difficult if you think a friend or family member isn't capable of making those decisions for themselves and may get hurt if treatment isn't carried out. Because of long waiting lists and a lack of specialist availability, it can be difficult for doctors to treat all of their patients as individuals, but reliance on technology can in itself create a lot of problems, especially if we continue down the road of people only being able to access care through AI, which would proceed down an established pathway regardless of individual needs as seen in the play. Regarding normal behaviour, the stigma around neurodiversity has reduced somewhat, but there are a lot of people saying that diagnoses are trendy at the moment and the incidence of neurodiversity isn't accurate. This increases people exhibiting masking behaviours and not being open about their experiences. For synesthesia, I think this is still unknown to most people, but there is still stigma there when you describe synesthetic experiences to people. I think stigma around mental health issues like neurodiversity is reducing, but only up to a point. I think there are mental health issues which are acceptable and people are encouraged to talk about them, but others which still have a high level of stigma, so people hide them. I found it really interesting that neurodiversity, synesthesia and mental health issues were all explored in the play together, as there is a crossover of that stigma and some of the elements of the experiences are shared, even though the three experiences on their own are very different. And I found it really sad that some people experiencing one of the three were upset about being associated with another experience by the play, exploring three different themes. And I think that this shows that stigma is still very much present when someone who has a different one of these experiences is offended by seeing someone else's experience explored alongside theirs, because they're not like those people.
You've been listening to Let's Talk Synesthesia. There'll be a new episode of Series 1 every Tuesday. If you enjoyed listening, you can like, follow and share. Details about the podcast and how to connect with today's speakers can be found in the show notes. The executive producer was Micah Pricing, with music by Karen Anderson, and the podcast was supported by a couple more neurodivergent people in the background. See you next week.